All right. Well, thank you all for coming. Appreciate it. Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. It's my wife Cynthia's restaurant. And thank you for eating. You're keeping us in business. I always like to see that when we're doing these events. We've made this a free, safe space for authors. So I've interviewed, I think you're the 141st author since we've opened here.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's just a place where authors can come. On any given day, we find writers downstairs and people talking and a lot of creatives. So it's really a special thing for us. It's my guilty pleasure talking to authors. So I'm looking forward to this. By the way, the food you're eating is based on my wife's family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt, from the original Alexandria. So we've come full circle.
That's right.
All right. So Andrea Walton is the founder and board chair of the Concrete Rose Scholarship Foundation. With more than 22 years of executive leadership in human resources, Andrea has built her career helping organizations and leaders navigate transformation with people-centered strategies. Her expertise spans talent management, organizational culture, and leadership development, always grounded in the belief that every individual has the potential to thrive when given the right opportunities. Can't tell you how much I love that, by the way.
That's great.
Andrea founded the Concrete Rose Scholarship Foundation out of her own lived experience and a deep commitment to creating pathways for students who face financial and systemic barriers to education. Guided by the principle that every step has led to this moment, she envisioned the foundation as both a scholarship provider and a source of mentorship, inspiration, and opportunity for young women worldwide. In addition to her philanthropic work, Andrea leads Concrete Strategies, LLC, her boutique HR consulting practice, and hosts the Table One Built podcast, where she amplifies voices of resilience and leadership. Through every endeavor, Andrea remains committed to advancing equity, building legacy, and empowering the next generation to bloom forward. So please welcome Andrea.
Thank you.
So first, congratulations on your books.
Thank you.
It's a big deal. I was just telling another author that some 82% of people say they have a book in them and they plan to write it, but only 3% of them ever start it, and only 1% of that 3% ever finishes it.
Oh, that's incredible.
So it's a big deal. It's one of the things we all read, and then you say, okay, let me put these ideas down, no
right.
matter what it is, and it's really difficult. So congratulations.
Thank you.
What motivated you to write? Let's start with the first one, right?
Yeah.
So your GED to MBA.
Yeah. Well, I had been, let me back up and tell my story. So I was a high school dropout and a teen mom at 15. And statistically, I wasn't supposed to get as far as I have in my life and in my career. And with my lived experiences, I wanted to share my story. Not only did those things happen, but I was also sexually abused by a family member at a very young age. And I knew that I had to be a voice, not just for myself, but other survivors. And so putting my words to paper was important. And over the years, I had shared my lived experiences with, like, teen girl groups and teen mom groups, but I knew it was important to put it in a book. And so that's really why I did what I did, and I've been sharing my story ever since.
So that's admirable on so many levels, right? So first off, you know, having a child at such a young age, I mean, I think it's I haven't seen the stats in a long time, something like 67-70% of, like, single young mothers are in poverty,
that's
right?
Right.
So it's so hard. It's such and it just makes sense with time and the commitment
that's
and the
right.
money that's involved, right? So how did you manage to get through that? Let's start there.
You know what? Several things. Resilience, my own faith, and belief that I could get past it, and build better for my daughter who's here today, who is my daughter that I had when I was 15. When I dropped out of high school, I knew that if I didn't at least get my GED, that I would be setting myself up for more failure. And the GED test was a two-day test in Southern California where we lived. And I had signed up for it going, I got to take this test. Because once I do this, then I can accomplish the next thing. And the days of the test, it was raining. And we didn't have a car, but my mom had a bike, a 10-speed. And so the days of the test, I rode the bike in the rain. And a few weeks later, I got the certification that I passed. And so from there, I checked a box and go, okay, I accomplished that. Now what's next? Okay, my undergrad. And since that point, it's always been like, let's just go after what's next. And every time I've not only shown my daughter and I have three kids, what success and kind of the picture of possibility, but also others that have been through the same thing.
So it just keeps getting better, right? So first off, where do you get that resilience? Like, because that's an internal thing, right? Did you have was there a mentor or somebody at that age? Or where did you get this? Because a lot of people faced with all these obstacles do not have the same mentality, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say it is the women in my life. My mother, my grandmother, both single women, both really hard workers. I saw my mom work two jobs sometimes to provide for us. And so quitting was not an option, and it never was. So to your point, it is internal but also external. I am still to this day very, like, full of grit, hard on myself. I got to accomplish the next thing. But I have to say it's my grandmother, Gloria Walker, and my mom, Yurith Walker.
How much of that is, like, you know, the nature versus nurture thing? Like, how much of it is in your family genetics that you have this work ethic? Because, obviously it's not a universal thing, right?
No,
and
it's
you see
not.
This, but also watching it and seeing it every day when you're growing up, that has to have a huge impact. But do you have how much of it do you feel like why does your mother and grandmother, where did they get it from?
I know. Well, I mean, it's just, you know, our history as a people, culture, family. Also, I've always felt like I describe myself as like a racehorse behind a gate. Like, I'm always ready to get out from behind the gate and go. And so I don't know what the percentage is nature versus nurture, but I know that I will go to my grave as a woman who's like, let's go, let's do this. Giving up is just not an option for me. And, you know, as a human, we all have those moments where you want to. I've had those moments where I'm like, God, but there's something in me that won't let me give up.
I love it. And so you've written this book, so I'm answering my own question I'm about to ask you. But, like, so it's teachable, right? Or you wouldn't have written the book.
Right.
To what extent are people open to this if they don't have, like, your mother and your grandmother in their lives, if they don't have that daily example, and maybe they don't have whatever it is that's inside us that drives us to, like, better our lives?
It's a good question. I think for many people, seeing what's possible is also a motivation. And so being able to see a black woman at the C-suite where it's only 4% of us at that definitely gives someone motivation to do it. I've had employees say to me, I said yes to this job because I saw you on the website. Or I said yes to this because I saw your story. And so as many of us can chart a path for others to hold the light up so that they can see that it's possible, I think that's part of it as well.
So, you know, you mentioned getting on your bike and driving through the rain to get it. Was that belief in education part of your family as well? Was that something that people talked about?
So it wasn't talked about a lot. I mean, I knew it was important, but I also knew that it was the unlock, right? Like, education, I've said it many times, has saved my life. Without it, I wouldn't have the career and the life that I've had. And so I knew it was important to my mother and to my grandmother to get my education, but it wasn't like, you got to go to college. It was just like, we are trying to survive. My mom's working two jobs, right? So for me, it was about, if I want to create better, I've got to make different decisions. And that's what I did.
So that logic, you're looking at it very rationally, right? You're looking at things and knowing you have to make changes. Yeah. Like, and I'm asking you questions which you probably can't answer, because I don't think anyone can, but I'm really curious, like, where that comes from.
I will tell you, when I was 17, I picked up a book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill and Dennis Kimbrough, and it changed my life. It was not just stories about rich in finances, but rich in every area of your life, and that literally the decisions you make can open up different seasons for you in your life and change the trajectory. And I have to say, outside of reading the Bible, because I'm a Christian woman, but that book was a game changer for me. And so even today I tell my son, you know, when you get older, I need you to read Think and Grow Rich. It was a light for me mentally. And so when we try to get to the root, I'd have to say I also started reading early books that would motivate me, even as a teen mom, going to the welfare office, but I would come back and read Think and Grow Rich.
So how did you discover that book? And where did that love for reading come from?
I've always loved reading. I don't know where it came from, because I've just always loved reading and knowledge. So I'm not sure exactly, but I've always loved that. And what was your other question?
Where did you find the book, or how did it come into your life?
Ooh, I may have to go into my old journals and find what I wrote, because I journaled since I was a teenager. I don't remember how I found out about it. It could have been me in a mall walking into Barnes & Noble or something.
I think I read it, too, a long time ago.
Yeah. And I still read it probably every 5 to 10 years just to refresh. But it is, I'm not sure how I found out about it, but I know when I read it, it was like, whoa, like, you mean you can change your life by changing your decisions? You mean that your life can become whatever you want it to be by making the right? Yes.
So, like, that idea of having agency, right? And being able, to go after your own destiny and do it through hard work and things. It's not a really popular idea anymore all across the culture, right? And so when you're doing this, like, it's interesting to see the connection to writing, right? And to reading. Do you believe that? I mean, and the reason I'm harping on all this little stuff,
because these
are literally the building blocks of success, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm asking, like, why were you a reader? And how did you find this book, and how did it influence you? Because, you know, you can talk about all the other stuff, sort of window dressing at the end.
But this
is the stuff, like, putting your head down and saying, you can't stop me, right?
Yes.
The resilience and putting your head down and getting on your bike and going through the rain.
Absolutely.
How many people out of 100 do you think would see it raining outside and saying, I'm going to go through the rain on my bike and risk all that to go take a test?
And you know what was, for me in my mind, was if I don't get on the bike, what happens to my life and to my daughter's life? Like, that's in my head. I knew that once I got that GED in the mail, that was like, okay, it is possible. Now let me go tackle what else I think might be impossible, which is an undergrad. Getting my undergrad for 4 years, you know, going to school for 4 years, felt like that was an impossibility. And then I was walking across the stage with my daughters watching me. And in the ceremony, one of the administrators asked me to carry the sign for the Bachelor of Science in Criminal Justice. And he was like, do you want to carry it? I was like, yeah. So I carried the sign in this stadium full of people in front of my daughters because I made a decision 4 years earlier to go, which I made a decision earlier to finish my GED. Like, I just thought of it. Maybe it could be just nature.
So how big is that, though, right, when you have a moment like that? Because it reinforces your decision-making to get to that point, right?
Yeah.
Is it important for people to celebrate those moments when they get them?
Oh, absolutely. You have to. Because not only is celebration reinforcing, yes, I made the right decision, but the ripple effects of that celebration. Now my daughters get to see that we don't have to live in poverty. My daughters get to see the efforts of education and working hard. It's not just me talking. They actually get to see it. So you must celebrate those wins with those that are in your community.
How much do you think that desperation you were talking about, like, if you don't get that, how much do you think that drives people? I'm always interested. You know, you see people grow up in, like, a wealthy family.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, each generation seems to get lazier.
Right.
You know, because they don't have that desperation.
Yeah.
And I see that with writers, too. Like, people who actually complete their work and people who finish their books
and start something. That's right.
But they always have a drive. Like, for some reason, they have to finish that book.
Yeah. For me, it was definitely some desperation. I saw my mom work really hard, and sometimes things didn't work out for her or my grandmother, or getting the food stamps and seeing the book of food stamps. And I knew that that was a part of our journey, and there was nothing wrong with that, but I also wanted more. And so wanting more meant there's a feeling of desperation that I've got to help lift us up out of this.
So, you know, there's like, what is it, with kids, there's a psychological experiment with, like, the donut. Like, it's a delayed gratification, right? They put it in front of them. If you wait long enough, you can have two or whatever.
Right.
And most of them can't. What is it about, like, because, you know, going back and getting a degree is hard.
Yeah.
And having, being a single mother is hard.
Yeah.
And all this is hard.
Yep.
So you have to have that driving vision. You have to see that on the horizon.
Yes.
What is it that allows you to even see that on the horizon? Or what keeps you going? Because I'm sure there were times when you were going through, even at that early stage in your journey, right?
Yes.
That you probably were thinking about, is this worth it?
Absolutely. I mean, there were times where, you know, when I was going to get welfare, I intentionally dressed up like I was going to a job interview. It was mental I don't want to go looking like what I need. I want to go looking like this is temporary. It's a mindset that I had. I don't know exactly where it came from outside of God and family, but it was important for me to make sure that I didn't stay there long.
Well, those are two big things, God and family,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I mean, the country's gotten away from religion,
it's
right?
True.
The family unit is broken down,
yes,
in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
A lot of, like, you know, single parent homes all over the place.
That's
too.
Right.
So do you think that has contributed to sort of the maybe a declining work ethic, or is it the wealth of the nation that also contributes to that?
You know, that's a great question. I don't want to attribute it necessarily to single parenthood, because sometimes things happen. You know,
mm-hmm,
people
sure.
have kids. But I do think that we have gotten away from the importance of education and things not just being handed to people. Like, there is a lack of, do I need to really work hard for this? Like, yeah, you do, actually. Like, it's not handed to you. So I wouldn't necessarily tie it to single parenthood as I would tie it more to a lack of grit, a lack of resilience, a lack of wanting to really work hard and go after some things, as opposed to it just being handed to you.
So what are the tools, like, that you would give, like, a young person now, mm-hmm, who's coming home from whatever, a school or a second,
yeah,
job, and they're like, on the one hand, I can do X to,
yeah,
to better myself,
yeah,
and to look down the road and work really hard with the hope that someday this will,
yeah,
pay off, versus,
yeah,
maybe sit there and play a video game all night.
Yeah, I mean, I'm having these conversations with my 12-year-old son, who likes to play Roblox all the time. And there's only so much, of course, he understands, but he's really wicked smart. But one of the things I tell him is, you can play now and pay later, or pay now and play later. And based on your decisions, let's get the stuff done now so that you don't have to think about it. And then it releases you to go on and do those things. And so he's starting to get it, but he's 12. So, yeah, but it is, let's pay for it now so you can play later.
I mean, that's a tough lesson to learn when you're 12.
Listen,
play is important too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But, boy, will that really help over the years.
It's true. It's very true.
So in your book, in GED to,
yeah,
MBA, what are the themes? And, like, if someone picks this up right now,
yep,
like, what,
yep,
what do you want them to come away from with this book?
Yeah, that no matter what the obstacles, that if you decide in your heart and your mind that you can overcome, you can overcome. That all it requires is a decision to be resilient and to make the right decisions, just one foot after the other. And so that's what I think people can take away, that no matter what hand you're dealt, you can rise above it.
So if you're talking to, like, a 15-year-old girl,
yeah,
who's maybe sitting at home pregnant going,
yeah,
wow, this was my story.
Yeah.
Like, where, other than your book,
yeah,
like, where would they go to see an example of this? Or where would they go to be able to see a pathway? Because that's part of the problem,
yeah,
right? It's a lack of role models in the everyday life.
It's true. I mean, one of the things that I do is mentor young people, whether it's going to schools and speaking publicly, one-on-one. So if there's a 15-year-old girl who's watching this that is expecting, you can reach out to me. Happy to walk alongside you. There's not many that can do that for young people, but I'm certainly happy to do that. And we'll, of course, pin my website. But I do that on a regular basis anyway.
So when you're writing this, you're telling your story. It's very,
yeah,
very personal, right? There's a huge difference between writing fiction and nonfiction, and then a huge difference between, like, a memoir and,
right,
and a leadership-based, or would you call this leadership? Really, it's a
yeah,
type of leadership.
It's
fiction,
a type,
right,
of leadership,
but it's also,
yeah,
a memoir. So,
yeah,
like, when you're writing these really personal things,
mm-hmm,
that's scary, isn't it?
It is. It is scary, and it exposes. Like, I feel vulnerable when I write about it. Right, telling people that I was sexually abused before I was 5 years old. That's scary to write about. And will people judge me? And, you know, all those thoughts that you have. But I also know that I'm not the only one who's experienced that. And I'm giving those a voice that may be too afraid to share their own story.
See, that's the one I told you this is admirable in a lot,
yeah,
of ways. That's the second half, right? First,
yeah,
half is being resilient,
yeah,
and escaping your circumstances.
Yeah.
And then the second half is that, is,
yeah,
like, willing to talk about it instead of putting it in your rearview mirror,
yeah,
just moving forward and taking what you've earned.
That's right.
You're also, like, reaching out and
that's
trying,
right,
to help other people.
Yes, and it's okay that even if you don't want to share if that's happened to someone, but hearing that it has happened and having someone model what they've done hopefully inspires them to continue to move forward and heal and get the help that they need. But yeah, I couldn't keep that bottled. I actually had to share that.
So it was writing the book cathartic in its own way,
yeah,
or like when you first started and you were writing,
yeah,
tell us a little bit about that, because I think it's really interesting. You,
yeah,
know, when a lot of people write this, it's terrifying to actually verbalize the,
yeah,
things, but maybe you're working through it in your,
mm-hmm,
head as you write it. Tell us kind of how that process went, like, emotionally.
Yeah. So I've been writing journals since I was a teenager, and I still have all of my journals. And so I have, you know, the dates and what I was thinking. Sometimes I read it, I was like, what was I thinking? But I took those journals and I started reviewing them and going through them and reliving some of those things and feeling sad sometimes for the young girl or the woman that I was, or excited, reading the excitement when I was like, oh, I got an interview or whatever the things were. And so I went through that roller coaster of emotions, just reading the words again that I wrote, and then deciding to put that into a book and having to confront the feelings that I had in the room when I was sexually abused, right? Having to remember looking down at the sheet, having to remember those thoughts that I had at 4 or 5, and then just having to relive those was hard in the moment. And it's still, you know, still hard to talk about it sometimes. But I knew that I had to share. One, I could no longer bottle up what had happened. And two, allowing myself to feel the emotion, was healing as well.
So when you're reliving a past trauma like yeah. that and you're putting it on paper, does it bring up memories that you didn't even have till that moment when you're actually doing the writing? Like, did it get more visceral or new things come up?
You know, it's a good question. I actually could feel the sheets again. Or I could, like, feel the, it's hard to describe, like, the temperature of the room. So, yeah, it definitely brought back even being in the room.
So was the writing process going through this, which must have been horrible,
yeah.
right? Was that sort of like you riding the bike to get your GED? Was that sort of like you're pushing through this horrible moment
yeah.
because you know once it's out and it's on paper, you're gonna heal more?
Yes, and I don't have to, if I don't want, relive it. Like it's in paper, it's there, and if someone wants to read it and hear my story and heal from it, they can. I push through it. For me and for anyone else that needs to heal from any kind of trauma like that.
Is that the difference between, like, talking to a therapist about a traumatic incident and writing it? Is that
huge.
Physically putting on paper where it's permanent and it's right there
yeah.
and people can see it and you can find it and you've done it and you've kind of put it out of you?
It's true. I mean, I have had moments where I'm like, ooh, I did put that in there. Like, I did share that. But it is different than going and sitting on a couch and sharing with a therapist and then leaving and it's just between you two versus whoever in the world can read about it. But I have just set in myself that not only was that the right thing for me, but for anyone else.
So when you finish this book and you hit send
yeah.
or whatever,
yeah.
right? Like it's actually out in the world.
Yeah.
How? Because it's scary if you're writing anything.
Is.
It's scary if you're writing fiction because you're
yes.
really putting yourself out there
yeah.
for criticism.
Yeah. It is a moment that I made the announcement on social, on Facebook when I first launched the book, and the outpouring of support and love from friends and family made it like, okay, that was the right decision.
So were you expecting or was that a big surprise? Because, you know, it could go, you don't know, right? You could have the exact opposite response.
I know, no. I partly expected like, oh, that's awesome. Like I partly expected that. But the way that people supported me sharing my story, it was like a wave of just support that I didn't expect. And so that felt really good. And it just confirmed that it was the right decision.
You know, because we have this shared humanity, right?
Yeah.
And so since you wrote this book and put it out in the mm-hmm. world, have you been contacted by a lot of people? Have you been surprised by how many people had similar circumstance and were then helped by your book?
I have been very surprised by women and some men who have reached out to say that they've experienced sexual trauma at a young age. And thank you for being brave enough to share my story. It has been overwhelming, actually, how many people have lived through similar experiences.
Do you know, like, what percentage of population goes through this, because I mean, I talk to people who, you know, who've written memoirs who go through this, but it seems like people are more open about it now than they were like 50 years ago, right? And everyone hid everything.
It's true.
And now it's out there more. And now that it's out there, it seems like a lot of people have experienced a lot of bad stuff that we just didn't talk about.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I don't know the percentage, but I do know that, to your point, so many people have experienced that type of trauma. And now it doesn't feel taboo to talk about it anymore. And it's because of stories like mine and others that people are willing to share and help other people share theirs. Or if not share theirs, just hear that it's okay to go through it and to heal through it.
So I mean, your goal was to therapeutic for yourself, but it was also to help other people and let them see, you know, what you've gone through. And do you think an unintended outcome may be that even these types of books change the culture, where if people are more open to it and talking about it, more aware of it, maybe people see this stuff earlier and can prevent things from happening or stop them from happening sooner?
That, you know what, that is an unintended consequence, that moms and dads or parents or whomever, guardians, are willing to ask more questions about who their kids are around, or being more cautious. I mean, I think that's probably where you get helicopter parents from, right? Like, now that I know, like, the big bad wolves are out there, you're not going anywhere, right? So maybe there's the opposite effect, too. But I do think it's opened the door for parents to have more open conversations with their kids about, are you comfortable going over there? Mm-hmm. Do you trust Mr. or Miss so-and-so? I mean, I've been that way with my girls and my son. Like, you don't just get to spend the night at everyone's houses. And you know, many times my own trauma has probably kept them too close, because I've been like, nope, you can't go over there. And I've made decisions based on my own hurt and trauma as well. So I think there is unintended, but also intended too.
Well, it's certainly well-intended.
Yeah,
your point,
yeah,
right?
You're
doing it for the right reasons, but that is a risk, right? Yeah. When people, as parents, are a little too protective, because you kind of learn through mistakes.
Yeah.
But that's a mistake you don't want to have to learn
that's
through.
Right.
So
that's
I guess,
right.
Where do you draw that line in being protective as a parent? You know, with not letting the really big trauma to happen, but you also want to let kids make mistakes and have some independence.
You know what? It's hard to say where you draw the line, because you have to be comfortable as a parent about where they go. I mean, it's getting to know who they're hanging out with. It's making sure you build community with, so you're not just sending your kids out. So it's hard to say where you draw the line. I know I've been very protective of my girls and my son over the years of just not wanting them to get hurt. And some of my decisions have been made well-intended, but just, I don't want them to get hurt. So no, you can't go. And they'll be like, but mom, I don't feel good about it, right? So it's hard to say where you draw the line. I just have been very protective of over my
kids. You know, if you're going to err in one direction, that's probably the one to go to.
That's right.
So this book, GED to MBA, that's been out for a while, right? What has the reception been like? And I'm curious about this, because it's very contrary to a lot of narratives that you see now, right? It's saying you have agency, you're able to take control of your life, and no matter what, you know, crappy situation you put yourself in, there is a pathway out, and you don't hear that much. I think it's really healthy.
Yeah.
So how have people responded to this?
I've gotten messages from people, especially that got their GED, that said, I was embarrassed that I got my GED. Thank you for being so vocal about an alternative way of getting your education. That was really brave of you. So I've gotten that a lot. I've gotten people that were also single parents that were going to school and working full time, and just like, thank you for being a voice for us working parents going to school. So a lot of thank you for shedding a light on some of these things that are happening that don't typically, that aren't typically spoken about.
Have you had any of the opposite reaction, where people feel like you're not maybe addressing some, like you mentioned, you know, financial and systemic challenges, that maybe you're not addressing that by putting so much on the individual to give them hope to get through these things?
I haven't gotten the opposite, but my belief is, like we've said, you have agency. Of course, there are things and barriers that people have to overcome. I had to. But at the end of the day, what decisions are you going to make to change your life? And what support do you need, and what questions do you need to ask? No one's coming to save us. So what decisions do you need to make?
So, like, what sort of, like, systemic roadblocks have you experienced or that you've witnessed that are broader?
Oh, I mean, everything from, you know, in our community, I grew up in apartments called Community Arms Apartments in Pasadena. Shout out to Pasadena. and it was so much gang and drugs in the 80s and 90s in my community. And lots of arrest and, you know, but there was one time I was playing on the playground in our apartments and there was a gang shootout and we were literally hiding from bullets while we were playing on the playground. And so, systemic things like that, I think, played a big part just in me looking at that. There was a time where a man was stabbed to death in our community and we took our bikes the next day and rode the trail of the blood to where the man actually had perished. And so it was things like that happening in our community. That was violence, that was gangs, that was drugs, that was very prevalent.
So beyond like the initial times you maybe see that kind of violence or something, at some point does it become the normal? Like at
some
point you just sort of get used to the level of
violence? Yes, yes. I mean, you get used to hearing the bullets and the gunshots. Hearing the police sirens. I mean, it got to a point where the pizza delivery guy stopped coming in to our neighborhood because they would get robbed and beat up, right? But you get used to hearing that. And that's not safe or normal, but you do get used to hearing those stories.
Do you now have unusual cravings for pizza?
Yes, I do. And wings. Shout out to Rustico. Yes.
So your second book, what drove you to do this again? Go through this whole difficult process again.
So after accomplishing, you know, all the things in the corporate space and navigating all the things that I navigated, I found myself in a marriage that was with tons of domestic violence. I was with a partner who was angry and demonstrated that anger and showed that anger to me. And in front of my kids and towards my kids. And it was very interesting to navigate ascending the corporate ladder while going home and dealing with someone who was violent. And I found that work became an escape. And I continue to have this great success in the corporate space while coming home and fighting for our lives.
So, you know, identity is really crafted through your behavior, right? Through your actions, through your experience.
Yeah.
So when you're like leading people in a corporate environment and then you're coming home and you're having to fight for your life, those are so diametrically opposed, right? Like how does that change the way you feel about yourself? And how does it come out of you? Does it come out? Does it drive anger? Or I would guess in your circumstance, it just makes you more determined to do something.
No, it was. It was, there were times where I was angry at myself, like, why didn't I see this? Or sad that my kids had to experience this. I was also, what changed about me was that I thought that I needed to do something to change him. So it was a constant, like, what do I need to do? Or, okay, kids, be quiet, or let's try this just so this person wouldn't walk on eggshells. So, but it did, you know, my brand is resilience. And so I was like, okay, so I need to put a plan together so I can make sure that my kids and I get out of this safely. And it was hell. It was hell. But thank God we made it out on the other side.
So I'm curious about like that initial reaction that you have, you know, what, like, why didn't I see this and why, you know, I've got to protect my kids and how did I put them? It felt like you went internally, like,
I
why
did.
Is this your fault?
I
right?
did.
And that happens a lot with like domestic violence.
Yes.
So why does that happen? Like why first look inward when clearly the problem is sitting across from you, right? And I'm not pointing at you.
No worries. I'll speak for myself. I know there are other people who have experienced this. I went internal first because I assumed it was my actions that brought this on. Because that's what you do in abusive situations. Remember, I was sexually abused. And so as a child, I thought that that was my fault, right? And so that thread continued throughout my life until I married this man. And so I initially was like, this is my fault. I brought this man around my kids. I need to do something now about it. But yeah, I definitely blame myself in the beginning.
So what would your advice be to other women who find themselves in this circumstance? Because I think it is a very common reaction.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's right. You know, I mean, it's right because obviously your background and
that's what comes through.
But how do they get away from that and realize they are not the ones causing the problem?
Well, I mean, statistically, when a woman leaves, that's when violence increases. And so I would tell a woman who's going through this, one, if you don't have support from your community, your family, reach out to organizations, to the police to get support and help. That's number one. And make sure that you get to a place that's safe and have a plan. So that's what I would encourage women to do. When I decided to leave, it was the scariest time. Naomi can attest to when I decided today's the day, we're done, I'm having him removed. And then for the next 2 to 3 years, it was horrendous. And so I will tell women who are going through this, don't share your plans with this person. Share it with people you trust. Contact local authorities. I removed the weapons from the house. I gave it to the police, and I told them I need help. It was hard, but there are things you do have to do. But when you decide to leave, that is when it's the most dangerous, and that is when you have to be the most careful.
So what do you think drives women when they're in these situations? Because I had a lot of experience in law enforcement early on with domestic violence, where they're physical, you know, physical, psychological abuse. But then when the police come, because things are really bad, they tend to want to defend their spouse or not press charges or not show up in court. Where does that come from?
It comes from, I need to protect myself. Because it can only get worse if that person isn't removed at that moment, right? You know, there was one time my daughter, who's here, called the police, and he didn't know it. And so the police came, and they pulled me out, and she saw my face and the tears, and she goes, "Do you want us to do anything?" And I said, "No," because I knew if he knew that it would only get worse for us. And so I think in those moments, it is mama bear being like, okay, what can I do in this moment to make sure that it doesn't get worse for us in this moment? You guys need to go away. And, you know, of course, that wasn't ever the right decision. But in that moment, I felt like that was the right decision.
You mentioned a part of you was wondering what you had to do to fix him, right?
Yeah.
So is that part of it, too, where you're feeling like, you know, if he gets arrested and all the other problems, financial and whatever that come from this, but if we stay home, there's still a way I can fix this?
There was a part of me in the beginning that felt like that. Towards the end, I knew that that was not something I could control, which is why then I made the decision it was time to move on, because I understood that there was nothing I could do, that it was all him and it was internal for him and he needed to make decisions for himself. So in the beginning, yes, I tried everything. Come to church. Come to this life group. Let's do this couples therapy. Let's do family therapy. All the things that he didn't want to do any of that. But then once I understood, it's actually not my job to fix him. He has to want to fix himself. And by the way, he has to leave here in order to do that.
So other than like dialing 911, what were some of the resources? You mentioned there's things available, but what did you find actually the most helpful? Like what would you recommend somebody do first?
Yeah, so the first thing I would recommend to anyone in that situation is, again, get with someone you trust to help you think through. Because when you're in a situation like that, you actually make decisions from fear and anxiety, and sometimes too quick or too, so like think through what are the steps I need to take. Secondly, and what I did was I called the non-emergency line for the police department and said, this is my situation. I need him removed. Please help me do this. And so there were some police officers that helped me walk through that. You can't do this alone. You have to involve law enforcement. You have to get therapy and support. And involve your church, friends, community. You cannot get through this alone. And those are the steps that I took to free me and my kids from it.
When you're reaching out to other people, trying to get advice, you know, you're in a bad emotional state, so you're looking for that guiding star.
Yep.
How do you know when to trust the advice of people who aren't in that situation?
Usually, if you're in a domestic violence situation, the people that love you the most know you're in it. Right, like it's not a secret. So my mother you know, she knew she didn't know how bad it was initially, but she did know. And so, like, she served him the restraining order. Like, you know, I had a couple of girlfriends that were like, Andrea, you know, when are you going to make a decision? So usually when you're in that situation, you've shared enough with people that love you the most that it's not a secret. Now they're just waiting for you to say, when are you going to, what are you going to do? And so you do have to be careful, though, who you share it with, because this is not something you can share with everyone. Share it with close confidant. If you are spiritual or religious, share it with your pastor or someone at your church. But I guess my point is, this is not something you can get through alone, ever.
So it's obviously a traumatic thing to go through. You've been through a lot of these things, right?
Know.
Like, I think you've had your fair share.
I think I'm done.
You should be done. But yet, you just continue to rise up, right? Yeah. Like, and you've hit all these marks. And what is the thing you've done that you've been most proud of?
I mean, removing an abuser from my home. And creating a space for my children to feel safe and loved, like my home is peaceful. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of, to create a space where they can not feel like something bad will happen and they have to fear for their lives. There's a lot of things I'm proud of, but that one is just to make sure that they're safe.
Do you remember that moment when he was removed from the house?
Yes.
And you had that quietness and lack of threat that was there. It was almost a tangible quiet.
Yes.
Do you remember that moment?
I remember it. I remember the night, because we didn't get to sleep until like 12:30 or 1 in the morning because it was so heavy. And I had someone come, or no, my daughter changed the locks. Like, we did everything that night, changed the keypad, and we went to bed finally. And it felt still like heavy, but like we did it. And for several weeks and months, we lived on eggshells because we thought he would come back. And so that's when I moved here to this part of Alexandria, because I wanted to get away. We were in Manassas. I wanted to get away from that home. But when we finally settled into our new place, I think that's where we felt like, wow, like, this is great. Like, we don't have someone that we have to worry about, you know. So, yeah, it felt good.
So, I mean, life has a lot of dangers, and it has a lot of stress, and a lot of things going on, and your home is supposed to be that place where you can come home and decompress and be safe.
Yes.
How does it affect your psyche when it's just the opposite? Like, coming home or being at home is actually the most dangerous place.
You're on edge all the time. You're on all the time. It is, I mean, my blood pressure was probably the highest it had ever been in my life during that period. I would get promotions at work and hide the promotion letters, because things like that would make him angry. I just changed everything about myself to make sure he was good. Gregory was good. Naomi, is everyone good? Like, constantly. And that's no way to live. But it was always like this increased anxiety. I mean, even to this day, I had like triple and lock my house. Like, and I don't have to. But that's one thing that still lingers. I have double locks on every entrance because it is just still there.
So you mentioned like the hiding the promotion letters.
Yeah.
How much of this, and how common is it for women who are successful in the corporate world to have a spouse who's not excited for that, but actually maybe intimidated by it?
I would say it's very, I don't know the percentages, but I would say it is very common. And it's unfortunate because you're supposed to be on one team, but it actually started to feel like he was competing with me. I came into the marriage with an MBA, and he was like, I got to get an MBA because I got to measure up to you, right? It was this constant, like, we're on the same team. So I do believe that for a lot of successful women, you may have partners who are intimidated, insecure. I don't know what it is because I just don't understand it. But I know that it's common, unfortunately.
It must be insecurity, right? Like, I can't,
I
don't understand it for the life of me. Like, I can't even understand where it could possibly come from, because it's so counterproductive, not just for the relationship, but for that person.
Absolutely.
Like, wouldn't you be excited that your spouse is doing well?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, wanting to bring them. And there were times where I created Walton HR Consulting, which is now Concrete Strategies. And I was like, we can build this together and we can do the, again, I couldn't fix them. It's not nothing I could do.
Oh, it's hard to fix anybody.
That's right. So, that's right. Got to focus on ourselves.
Why don't you tell us about your foundation?
Yeah. So the Concrete Rose Scholarship Foundation, I established it during the pandemic, actually. It was always a dream of mine to give back to girls who have similar upbringings like mine. And so I created, initially it was the Andrea Walton Scholarship, but I was like, I don't need it to have my name to be effective. And quite frankly, Concrete Rose. Rose is the city of Pasadena where I grew up, and then I grew up in Concrete community. And so that's where I got the name from. But I want to put as many young women, especially black and brown girls who don't have the access and the dollars through university, through college, as much as I possibly can. I have partnerships with the University of Cape Town in South Africa and Howard University. I'm in talks with Post University in Connecticut. And we're just going to keep this thing rolling and send as many girls as possible through college.
So how do you reach out to them? How do they find you?
Yeah.
Like what's, you know, especially if you're talking about in communities or maybe the education is a value.
Right.
Or they don't have the role model.
Yeah.
How do you get into the place where you're most needed?
Yeah. So one thing I just started when I started the scholarship, I started just online with Andrea Walton Scholarship, and then I started reaching out to communities and organizations, letting them know I had the scholarship. And then I also reached out to Howard University as the first U.S.-based university that I could partner with, and they were very welcoming, and yes, let's do this. For South Africa, I've always wanted to partner globally. That was the first place I wanted to go. That's another podcast because I'm in love with South Africa so very much. And so I reached out to them and said, I have this scholarship and I want to help. And they were like, absolutely. And so for me, it was just about taking initiative and going, who can I start with? Mm-hmm. And then, and through the partnerships with Hope and others, getting the scholarship out there in the community so people know that it's there, it's a resource, and really, it's been word of mouth and my website.
How many people have you helped so far?
So far, we've had about 12 students, and we've given out over $10,000. And, you know, my hope, my strategic plan for the organization is in the next 5 years, we can get up to $100,000 and, you know, at some point pay for full rides for at least 10 to 20 students per year. That's what I want to do. So we're starting small, but
it's an amazing goal, though.
Yeah.
And what I find really cool about it is it's because you're not just changing one person's life.
Yeah.
It's the people around them who see it happening,
yes.
Right? And then what
That's
they'll
right.
do and their kids. And, like,
That's
it,
right.
it just kind of the
yes.
ripples out, right?
That's right.
You're going to reach a lot of people.
Absolutely.
This way.
And it's exactly what's happened in my life. The ripples of education, the ripples of making decisions, one right decision after the other, that my kids and my community has been able to see.
So for those kids who don't have the mother and the grandmother like you did, you've got the stories here, right?
Yeah.
How do you get that out? How do you get that word out beyond the scholarship? Like, this is a message that people really need to hear.
Yeah, I mean, thank God for social media. Thank God for podcasts like this. Thank God for our board of directors. It is that, right? You know, outside of me writing in the sky, I am going to continue to use my voice and bang the drum that this is here to help as many kids as possible. And so, yeah, I'll continue to use platforms like this to get the word out. And the universities that I'm partnering with are also putting it out to their students as well.
What about going to, like, public schools? Is
yes.
that something you could at least get into the libraries, if not more something a little more visible?
Yes. Well, I'm glad you brought that up. So I'm partnering with Alexandria City Public Schools, and I've been partnering with the superintendent and that team. I started just this past summer with helping young black and brown girls get their hair done and school supplies, and then donating to Alexandria City Public Schools. So I am partnering within the community of Alexandria to start that way. They've also asked me to mentor, which I will be taking that on in the coming months as well.
In all your free time?
how many
jobs are you doing now?
Man.
The podcast and the foundation.
I know. Listen, I mean, we were having a conversation earlier. Like, none of us make it out of this thing alive. And so I'm going to continue to do everything that I can to better the lives of others. That's why I'm here.
Have you put these into audiobooks?
I haven't.
So I know they have AI now. It's not great, but yeah. It's getting really close.
Yeah.
And I've interviewed a bunch of narrators here, and there's a lot of organizations. But, you know, people learn differently.
Yeah.
And some people, you know, you could reach a whole different group if you had this available. And I know you can do it for free, for example, on Amazon.
Okay.
You know, just to start as a placeholder until you maybe get something
Well,
else.
Then I'll have to do that because, to your point, you know, not everyone wants to sit and read, but I love Audible or, you know, so we absolutely, I'm down for that.
Well, tell us we're getting short on time here, but just tell us a little bit about the publishing journey here. You decide to write this. There's a lot of ways to publish nowadays. Why did you go this route, and what was your experience?
So going the self-published route felt like it was something more that I could control. I mean, my daughter who's here today, I think she had self-published a book prior to mine, and I was like, help me understand how to do, like, it's been reverse mentoring. So I was like, help me understand how to do this. And so she helped me understand that I could do it on my own. And so that's why I did it. Now, if I do write another book, you know, I may explore a different route, but that was the route that felt more seamless to me.
It's a big market for sure, right? So you certainly would have other options if you were interested in it.
I am.
I feel like in a way your life was self-published.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's true.
You sort of took the reins and did it all yourself.
Always.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And so I just have to ask, we do writers here, right?
Yeah.
Just your process. Did you write at a certain time of day? Did you write every day? Tell us a little bit how that worked for you.
Yeah, so I did write a little bit every day in the beginning. And then once I got kind of some of the main chapters and the outlines of how I wanted to approach the story, then I would come to it every couple days. And weeks. And then once it got to the end, then I partnered with an editor who I sent all of it to. And then she and I would go back and forth on editing some of the language and the grammar and things like that. So it was a process that first I dove in, and then I had someone from outside look at it, still continue to keep the dignity of the story, but clean it up for me.
Have you looked at doing, like, articles or short snippets, ideas within it that you could put out in social media or put out in other routes as a way to drive people to the book, but also to get the ideas across?
No, but I can certainly learn from you on how to do that.
Okay. Well, we can talk about
okay.
it. Fantastic. All right, so I want to go. Does anybody have questions while we're on this, on the podcast? And if they do, we can just repeat them for the people who are going to be viewing.
I do have one question. Since you're, like, juggling everything that you've just accomplished so much throughout your whole career, what do you do to, like, decompress mentally? Like, how do you find time for yourself? Like, because you've taken care of so many people, what you've experienced, like, your mindset goes to, how can I take care of everyone else?
Yeah.
What do you do for yourself to just, you know, decompress, relax, like, reset yourself? What would you recommend?
It's important. It's so important. And so I have a pretty disciplined routine every day, not surprising. And so I get up, I pray, I meditate, I work out, and I make sure that I have space and time in the morning before I get my son up for school. And so that is what I do to make sure that I just stay grounded. It's just like breath work, meditation, and things like that. Also, you know, a girl loves to go to the spa every now and then. A restaurant outing every now and then. But I think the more regular day-to-day things is I have to meditate, I have to work out or yoga or something. Just get in tune between me and God. Like, okay, God, what are we doing today? And that's how I stay grounded or try to stay grounded.
You know, you've got all the tools working. That's really good. I mean, I'm so
you.
Impressed with
oh,
this. You're doing
you.
So much.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I feel like I have a question.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you have an answer.
Okay.
That needs to be heard.
Okay.
So, day to day, like we've heard, like, these serious highlights and hooks that people can hang on.
Yeah.
Like, you know, domestic violence, abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But then I feel like there are those other things, those other knots in the thread that could have also, sometimes it's the smallest thing that can like knock you off your ladder.
Yes.
Have you come across those things and how have you, when your resilience wasn't resilient, what have you done in those moments?
So just for the podcast,
yeah, sure.
Little things that can set you back and can knock you off your pathway, and how do you deal with these things when they come up, because they inevitably do.
They do. I mean, you know, on my corporate journey, being a Black woman in corporate spaces, I have experienced microaggressions and folks that didn't want to see me in these spaces, and you know, having to be told, well, we don't see you as a leader here. We see you more as a utility player. And just those kind of words that are used in corporate spaces that don't tell you no, but tell you no. And so those things could have knocked me off, could have been like, okay, dang, well, I guess I shouldn't try and go after that vice president role, or I shouldn't apply to that. But that only, I was like, okay, I'll show you. Then I'll just apply here and go get that vice president role. And so I let nothing stop me. And that is the key. I also continue to read even now every day. One of the books I'm reading right now is by John Maxwell called Talent Is Not Enough. And it talks about just tools to overcome some of those things that are not the big things, but that are the small things. I really believe success happens in the discipline, in the small work, when no one sees it, right? It is putting the phone aside and deciding to work on my business or the organization. It is what's the internal work that I need to do. And so it's those things that I do on a regular basis that are outside those big things.
Seems to me if somebody didn't want you in a specific position, telling you you couldn't have it is probably the worst thing they could do.
Oh, okay. All right. Got you.
You will get on your bicycle and go there and apply.
Listen, if I will ride my bike in the rain, best believe I'm going to go after it.
I love it. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you. This has been wonderful.
You.
We will put a link up for your for your foundation on our website.
Awesome.
So
thank
keep
you
up the good work.
Much.
I'm so impressed.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you.